Welcome back, Question Medicine. 2019, this is Andrew Bill, and I am down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. And before we start, before this episode gets underway, there's a new primary care CME out there that is awesome. It's finally released right on Prime. The link will be in the show notes to this episode. The link's also online. Just search for Right on Prime. It's free. Free 50 free. For those of you that want to listen, at least for the first month, it is free. Now, I know that this podcast, as well as every other podcast you listen to on iTunes or Stitcher, wherever you get your podcast, are wonderful because they're free. They are also free. But doing this, the podcasting in general, is not free. In fact, reading all these articles and putting them in a little context in which you can enjoy them doesn't pay any money at all. So all of us that put these together almost always work on the CME side as well, because we got to get paid somehow, even if it's a minimal few small peanuts. But I encourage you to go check it out. I do encourage you to go look at it, listen to it. And if you like it, then please, by all means, sign up. It is still a ridiculous amount of CME hours for what you're getting. I mean, it's really insane. And plus, you get the online show notes and the cliff notes, and you get board review, you get journal breakdowns, more than you're getting here. You get guideline breakdowns, you get stories, you get it all. It's really fantastic. But don't take my word for it. Go check it out yourself. Now, with that, let's get back to the episode, or let's at least start the episode, I guess. So without further ado, without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. All right, here we go. Let's get it going. You already know the deal by now. It's another week, another day, another dollar. It's another audio podcast for your eardrums coming right at you. This first article I'm going to get into is in the New England Journal of Medicine, a randomized delay start trial of levodopa in Parkinson's disease. Oh, yes, that's right. This article has me so excited, I'm shaking. That is a terrible Parkinson's joke. I'm sorry, but you'll at least remember it. Here's what they did. They said, if we start medication early, can we prevent Parkinson's? Or can we prevent at least the symptoms of it? Because we know that the main treatment for Parkinson's disease is the dopamine precursor, levodopa, carbidopa, levodopa, carbidopa, levodopa. And we know that almost all patients end up on carbidopa, levodopa, carbidopa, levodopa. But in 2004, there was a trial, the L-DOPA trial, which was earlier versus later levodopa therapy in Parkinson's disease, and it had some mixed results because it showed that patients that received levodopa did not deteriorate clinically to the level that was observed in the placebo group. Those findings then suggested that treatment with levodopa, carbidopa, levodopa resulted in clinical slowing of the disease. That would be awesome, my friends. That would be fantastic. Well, in that same exact study, again, without an up, there is no down. Without the waves coming in, they cannot go back out. In that same exact study, patients were then taken and they were imaged. Their brain was imaged and it showed a greater decline in transporter in the levodopa groups compared to the placebo groups. This suggests that maybe levodopa then was accelerating degeneration of the dopamine nerve terminals, or that the pharmacological effects of levodopa affected the transporters. That's no bueno. So what do you do? What do you do? Because either way, this is bad to be better clinically, but worse on image. I mean, the trial was only 40 weeks, so maybe you're better clinically for 40 weeks, but when we look at it at 100 weeks, we're actually doing way more harms. What do you do? What do you do? Well, this trial looked at just that. It is the LEAP trial. Levodopa in early Parkinson's disease. It was 450 patients randomized to carbidopa, levodopa, 100 milligrams, 25 milligrams for 80 weeks, or received placebo 3 times per day for 40 weeks, followed by oral levodopa, carbidopa. Now, the primary outcome was the difference between the early start group and the delayed start group in the mean change from baseline to week 80 in the total Unified Parkinson's Disease Rating Scale. Now, if you're not familiar with what that is, neither was I. But it's four parts. There are multiple parts to each section. You get 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. 4 is really severe. 0 is normal. And the score, then you add it all up at the end, and it indicates the severity of the disease. And you were looking at 199 points means you're totally disabled, and 0 means no disability. Now, the design of this trial was absolutely brilliant because, again, you had either the group recognized a treatment or put to treatment was on carbidopa levodopa for 80 weeks, and then they had the other group not start until week 40. This is brilliant. Why is this brilliant? Well, let me explain. If levodopa slowed disease progression, then those exposed for longer would have a better clinical outcome at the end of 80 weeks. But if it only works on the symptoms, then those delayed and didn't start until week 40 would merge together with those that were already on therapy. And at the end of 80 weeks, they would all be the exact same. In the end, there was no difference. There was no significant difference between the early start group and the delayed start group in the primary outcome at the end of the observation period, which again was 80 weeks. Now, this trial should not change your practice. It should probably confirm your practice. There is no evidence that early initiation of levodopa-carbidopa slows progression of the disease. On the other hand, there is no reason to delay therapy when it's clinically indicated. If your patient is suffering from Parkinson's disease, by all means, start the medication. Give them symptom control, because that, at this time, is all we can do. Give them symptom control. Now, on to the next piece of information. And over the next months, many, many months, actually maybe the next year, I will be talking about cholesterol. Just tidbits here and there, just to give you a little pearls and wisdoms and gems that I've been reading about. And I will explain why I've been reading about cholesterol so much when it's all said and done. But something I just recently read about, this blew my mind, was that the variability per person in cholesterol is give or take 10. What does that mean, Andrew? It means that if I come in today and let's say my cholesterol is, I don't know, I'm going to make up an easy number, 100. I come back tomorrow, the interperson variability in that 24 hours, maybe it's 110 or maybe it's 90. Okay, so that's the interperson variability, or the inner within the person day-to-day variability, excuse me. And then the lab variability, right? They give us a point estimate when we do any test, really, but there's always confidence intervals that then surround these point estimates. The confidence interval that surrounds a point estimate for cholesterol, or LDL, is about 2.5 either side. So that's a total of 5 if you're following along at home. So you have to add those together. So it's 10 plus at least 2.5. And 2.5 is by the best measurements I can find. It's even usually closer to 5. So we're looking at, if you, again, had an LDL of, 100. It's at 100, but actually, the real numbers are probably plus or minus 10 to 15 either side. 110, probably actually closer to 115 or 85. I mean, oh my goodness. If you're out there and you're rechecking cholesterol over and over and over, trying to find some major fix in some number, I mean, give me a break. You can't even get outside the error of the test, because the interperson day-to-day variability of the test and the just inaccuracy of the test in general makes it so it's just not possible. Ugh. There will be many more eye-opening pearls about this coming in the future with all kinds of things. Let me tell you, I got them coming, and then I'll explain it all in the very end why I spent so much time reading about cholesterol. But enough of that. Let's talk about one more paper that maybe shouldn't change your practice because it's worthless, but I am only mentioning it because I want to mention why I think it's worthless. The paper that I'm referring to is angiotensin neprilysin inhibition in acute decompensated heart failure. This is in the New England Journal of Medicine, published February 7, 2019. This is a randomized, multi-center, double-blind, active controlled trial. It took just over 880 patients hospitalized with heart failure with reduced ejection fraction. They then randomized them to sacubitril plus valsartan or enalapril. They were looking for the average change in the BNP. And wouldn't you know it, when you did the whole thing out and you calculated the whole change, if you were randomized to sacubitril plus valsartan, you had a almost double the rate of change, or double the percent change in your BNP. Oh my goodness. The reason that this is a terrible trial and this shouldn't change anything, is it because we're looking at 8 weeks. What was your change in the BNP if you took this medication compared to this medication? Two things here. One, at 8 weeks, why do I care about your BNP? Two, why do I care about your BNP? The BNP, while it might be a relatively decent, I will give it that, decent blood test when you're in the emergency room and we're trying to say, is this heart failure? Is this maybe a PE? Is this pneumonia? What is this? We know that trending a BNP, worthless. Getting a BNP before discharge, worthless. The BNP is not beneficial. It has not proven beneficial. It's never been beneficial. We want it to be beneficial, and it's not. So why would any company, why would any drug makers, why would any authors make a study that looks at a surrogate marker that hasn't been proven to be beneficial for outcomes that we care about, like death or rehospitalization or mortality or heart attacks or anything, something that the patients and myself actually care about? Ugh, frustrating. And speaking of things that are frustrating, this paper titled Effects of Oral Anticoagulation and Aspirin on Performance of Fecal Immunochemical Test in Colorectal Cancer Screening. Whew, another mouthful of an article title, and this was in Gastroenterology. This looked at just short of 5,000 participants. All participants had tested positive for a FIT test, the fecal immunochemical test. That is right, the test that we look for in colorectal cancer. Now, I'm going to get a whole deep dive on colon cancer screening in the future, but they took these patients, and out of these almost 5,000 patients, 1,000 of them were using aspirin, just over 150, or right about 150 were using warfarin, just over 200 were using some sort of DOAC, and 3,500 were non-users altogether. What this study basically did was, it said, look, you are on a medication, such as a DOAC, warfarin, or aspirin, and it makes you bleed. Okay, well, FIT tests are based on, are you bleeding in your stool? So if you're on a medication that makes you bleed, how does that medication affect the positive predictive value of a FIT test? So they had everyone who tested positive for a FIT test then get a colonoscopy. And they looked to see, was this a true positive or a false positive? And the results, oh yes, let's get to the results. 3.8% for aspirin users versus 6.4% for matched non-users. That sounds like a big deal. And you say, well, they're on aspirin, so obviously, I mean, they're going to have a few more false positives because you're on a drug that, you know, the platelets make them slippery and then they bleed. And I get it. But let's look at DOACs. DOACs, positive predictive value, 0.9% versus 6.8% for non-users. Again, matched non-users. And you say, again, wait, that makes sense. They're on a DOAC, they're going to have higher rates of bleeding because DOACs make you bleed more than aspirin does. So, there we go. Makes sense. I get it. But there was no difference in the positive predictive value for colorectal cancer or advanced adenoma in warfarin users compared to matched non-users. That doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense that warfarin wouldn't make you bleed more. I don't understand. I don't know how to make the connection here. I don't get it. But maybe this is one time when you can chalk up a win for warfarin. However, I have to say, after reading this study, I would still get a FIT test. I would still rather have a DOAC than warfarin because I don't want the testings and the INRs that come with being on warfarin. And as I'm going to talk about in future podcasts, this study also used what is confirmation or verification bias, meaning you didn't get a colonoscopy unless you had a positive FIT test. Well, if you really wanted to see what the effects were, you should do a colonoscopy on everyone that gets a fit test. But instead, you're only doing it on those people that are already testing positive for the first test. You're confirming or you're verifying your positive result, when really, you should probably be doing everyone to see what's going on. I will explain more about this during a future colorectal cancer screening podcast, but that just seems to be how every single study is done with fit tests, and it drives me bonkers. But I suppose there's a lot of things in medicine that drive me crazy or drive me bonkers, and one of those is when I see a physician or provider doing something that I obviously know is wrong, that I know from my soul of soul the evidence says there is no benefit. In fact, there is probably harm, like some sort of snake oil, if you will. But much of medicine is getting the patient to believe in what you're doing. And I do truly believe that most physicians everywhere truly believe in what they're doing. They do believe it's the best for the patient at the time. They're not malignantly trying to hurt anyone. Maybe one of the best examples of this that we have is meniscectomies. Anyways, when you're taking out the meniscus, we know from studies that it's not beneficial. In fact, in Europe, they have said, you can't do this anymore. We're not paying you for it. This isn't there. No more. Shut it down. But yet, here in America, it's done over and over and over again. And I do think that the orthopedic surgeons or the surgeons that are doing it think that they're giving benefit. Well, let's go on to an article that talks about, for sure, convincing people that this is beneficial, and then they just naturally believe that it's beneficial. This article, it was in BMJ Open, which was titled Efficacy of Standardized Acupuncture Approach for Women with Bothersome Menopausal Symptoms, a Pragmatic Randomized Study in Primary Care. This looked at 70 women with moderate to severe menopausal symptoms. The intervention group received one acupuncture treatment for 5 consecutive weeks, and the control group was offered treatment after 6 weeks. The differences between randomization groups was in the Menno Scores questionnaire. Wait, you don't know what the Menno Scores questionnaire is? Well, neither did I. I had to look it up, but it's, as you can figure out from just the name, it's a score talking about hot flashes and cramps and a bunch of hormonal menopausal questions that I'm not going to dig into on this podcast. Now, historically, the better the trial for acupuncture, the worse acupuncture holds up. For example, a trial in the Annals of Internal Medicine 2016 titled Acupuncture for Menopausal Hot Flashes, a randomized trial in which they randomized it and they used sham acupuncture. Blunt tip needles was the sham score. In that one, the women were randomized to receive 1-to-1, 10 standardized real or sham treatments by educated, registered, non-blinded, that's good, we don't want to blind them because we don't want them to stick the needle right where it needs to be, acupuncturist for 8 weeks. And the outcomes were based on hot flash diaries. At the end of the treatment, the hot flash scores had decreased from 26 to 15 in the acupuncture group and 24 to 15 in the sham group. A statistically insignificant difference. But remember, the study at hand, the one that we're talking about right now, didn't have a sham group. This was acupuncture versus control, or rather, acupuncture versus nothing. And look at injections of the knee. Needles do better than nothing, but not better than fake needles, besides for being no sham control arm or no blunt needles for this. Women were recruited from clinics and the newspaper. If you're willing to call in for a treatment from the newspaper, you are desperate. You are willing to do anything. You want to believe in your soul that this is going to be good for you. It shouldn't come as any surprise that by 6 weeks, women in the intervention reported improvement in hot flashes, sleep disturbances, as well as other emotional and physical symptoms that were improved. I guess in the end, if you want the patient to get better, believe in what you're telling them and what you're selling them. Because if they believe it, it can work. Even when the best blinded, low risk of bias studies that we have says it can't work? Well, it turns out that if they believe it can, then it almost certainly can. Now, we have right about our 20-minute mark, so let's do a quick review and end this podcast as we've ended every podcast before it. All right, and here we go. It's going to be a quick one because there was only 4 quick studies, so 30 seconds or less. If your patient has symptomatic Parkinson's, then don't wait, don't delay. Go ahead and start. Carvedilla, levodopa, carvedilla, levodopa. Do have no fear. And the BNP is worthless. Maybe beneficial one time in the ER. Okay, fine. I'll give you that. But other than that, trending it, looking for it at follow-up, it's worthless. And I hate when studies use terrible surrogate outcomes or worthless outcomes. Let's get to a point where every study is using patient-oriented outcomes. And warfarin doesn't change the positive predictive value of a fit test, but aspirin and DOACs do change the positive predictive value. Not really sure what to make of this other than to tell you, for me, if I get AFib, I'm still using a DOAC. And when time comes time for colon cancer screening, you better believe it's going to be a fit test. And last but not least, acupuncture. Works for menopause if you believe that it works for menopause. But just like all things acupuncture, the better the trial, the more likely it doesn't actually work when we do double-blinded sham needle control trials. Well, there you are. There you have it. It is time to end this podcast as I have ended every podcast before. So until next time, keep the quest and questioning.